Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on Monday on 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. Coming up on today's program, some U.S. schools are thinking about teaching the Constitution. Sounds like a pretty good idea. We've got some details about that. Also, a forbidden book smuggled out of North Korea. Yeah, you heard that right, out of North Korea. Looks pretty interesting as well. And some extinct animals may not be extinct after all. We've got some details about that and plenty more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG. We are online too, kpcg.fm, and a live link at thetrumpet.com. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondo here today with me. And a nice rainy weekend for all of us here in the local area. Got some good rain and had a little bit of a lazy Sunday. I was busy, but didn't do a lot outside because of the rain. Enjoyed it, though.
Yeah, it's always nice. I always feel refreshed after the rain, like I took a shower, even though I'm inside and dry on my couch.
You might want to check that roof.
Yeah.
You can check and get some roof problems there.
Yeah, free water.
So. Yeah, so we always need it here. It's dry in the summer a lot of times, so it's good to get that rain. So we enjoyed that. A little bit of breaking news here this morning. This has happened the last few hours. There's at least, several people at least dead in an explosion on a metro train in St. Petersburg, Russia. Russian President Vladimir Putin, who is in St. Petersburg for a meeting with Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko, said the cause of the blast was not clear. The Russian Anti-Terrorism Committee says it has found and deactivated a bomb at another St. Petersburg subway station. Reuters is providing live coverage of the explosion and its aftermath, and other websites as well. So that's a terror attack potentially there in Russia. I saw another headline saying ISIS was celebrating. I don't know that means they were involved. Anytime something like this happens in Russia, you just don't know what's going on over there. So details, I'm sure, will be emerging.
Yeah, it could be terrorism. It could be possibly the government doing it to its own people if we just judge by what has happened in the past. So it's really difficult to tell. And also, when you're talking about ISIS celebrating, that doesn't really always mean a whole lot. They're going to be excited about any kind of destruction.
Yeah, there's been plenty of recorded history of terrorism over there being not what it seems in the past. But who knows about this one? It's always a little murky, particularly when it's in Russia. But that's one of the breaking stories today anyway. We haven't seen a lot of terror over there since probably, what would have been the last thing? That school maybe? Remember back in, it was years ago, but that was those kids were killed at that school. That was kind of a murky situation as well.
Yeah, I think ever since Russia defeated Chechnya, there really haven't been too many terrorist attacks, because that's where they emanated from mostly. And I don't think Iran and other countries sponsor too many attacks against Russia, since Russia helps Iran, which is the biggest state sponsor of terrorism in the world. So in a way, Russia is indirectly aligned with most terrorist groups through that channel.
Yeah, terrorism definitely isn't equal opportunity.
Yeah.
It does target specific areas. So that's a story that's happening today. Also, make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. If you couldn't catch it live this morning, you can get the archives at kpcg.fm or thetrumpet.com. We have some replays on the station as well. And thetrumpet.com, the featured story today, what does an election without voters look like? The answer? Hong Kong. They give you the answer right at the beginning, and they give you more details. But they're not going to keep you guessing.
Wow. Yeah, Hong Kong's really interesting because it's former British colony, has democracy, quote unquote, but it's not really democracy because the leaders are they're elected, but there is no election process. It's really interesting system they have over there, and I think Mr. Underwood explains it very thoroughly in the article.
Yeah, so check that out at thetrumpet.com. Also, some related stories to that. The Songs of Hong Kong by Jeremiah Jacques, and Russia and China in Prophecy. Those are some related items there as well. This is an interesting story here from the Associated Press. This could potentially be a really good thing. They say, know your U.S. Constitution. More states look to teach it. So there's some schools that are trying to get back into teaching the Constitution and a few other founding documents for the United States. I think it sounds like a good idea, at least on the surface.
Yeah, hopefully. I don't know the details, but that's definitely something that has been lacking in education, something that every single American needs to know about.
Yeah, one of the teachers here that they interviewed points out how they've had some pretty good class discussions recently talking about things that are happening in the news, and they're able to go back and talk about some of the foundational principles of the country as opposed to just reacting to whatever they heard on the nightly news or the internet or whatever they're looking at. So in that, I think it could be a good idea. They say, should U.S. high school students know at least as much about the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Federalist Papers as immigrants passing an American citizenship test? That's kind of what they're looking at. I think there's about 100 questions that you have to answer if you want to become a U.S. citizen. And they're saying if you, when you graduate high school, you should be able to answer those as well.
Yeah, it's really that's really important, especially now when you see all these man on the street videos and just how shockingly ignorant of history most people are. It's pretty disturbing. Like Waters World has a lot of examples of that where people don't know there were two world wars. They don't know who won the world wars, things like that. And how can that be possible? How is that going to be productive in this republic, the greatest nation that has ever existed? I mean, that just kind of reminds you of, I haven't seen the movie, but Idiocracy, I guess that's what it's about, where everyone is just completely stupid and ignorant, and it doesn't really turn out too well for that nation.
And I think, kind of related to that, I think, Abraham, I think maybe you had a write-up on it, but it was, you talked about it before, it was about how the current generation, or I guess it'd be the current generation in school, there's sort of a pride in ignorance. Like, they don't know certain things, but instead of being embarrassed about it, they're sort of proud of the fact that they don't totally know, but they've got an opinion. And that's where it gets really dangerous. I mean, not knowing something's not is not a good thing. But when you have a very strong opinion that's not based on knowledge, that's an even worse situation, I think.
Yeah, that was the research done at the University of Wisconsin, where for the past decade, the researchers noticed that the students have gone from being ignorant but wanting to learn about the past, about the founding fathers and different historical events, to where they're not only ignorant or willfully ignorant, and they already have a politicized opinion about it, saying Andrew Jackson was a slave owner. They don't want to know about the racist, sexist history of the United States, all those sorts of things. And it reminds me of, this is not in America, but in Britain, which I think is, they're usually closely related in this field. I think about 30% of British teenagers in the poll taken thought the American Revolution was won by Denzel Washington.
No.
And not George Washington.
No way.
No. Yeah, that's what came out to be.
Wow. Well, he's a good actor, but yeah. He was not alive at that time, nor involved. This article says, in a growing number of school systems, having such a basic knowledge is now a graduation requirement. It wasn't when I went to school. But states are taking different approaches to combating what's seen as a widespread lack of knowledge about how government works. There might be a lack of knowledge in the government about how government works now that I think about it. Seems like anything goes these days. Kentucky last week and Arkansas on March 16th became the latest of more than a dozen states since 2015 that have required the high school social studies curriculum to include material covered by the 100 questions asked on the naturalization exam. So, you haven't taken that yet, Abraham, have you? You're Canadian.
No. Yeah, I've taken the Canadian naturalization exam. You have to eat 100 pancakes in a minute. So.
You passed.
Yes.
You and John Candy. let's say lawmakers in other states, including Minnesota, are hoping to foster even deeper understanding of the fundamentals of American democracy by adding a full course to study its most important documents. So that could be really good. The only thing I could see, the only counterpoint to this in the article is that some people feel that it would just be teaching for the 100 questions and not going deeper. But I think that's a good start. It's a good start. The only thing that might be a problem is the way it's taught, you know, if it's presented in a negative light or it's made to look bad, like the Constitution, that wouldn't be good. But if it's presented fairly, I think it'd be a great idea.
Objectivity would be extremely important there. It doesn't matter whether the teacher leans left or right. If you can look at individual decisions today and say, is this based on the Constitution or not, that would be fine, but you can't let your bias get in the way of whatever that truth is.
Yeah, and that would be the tricky thing about it. But we didn't, we had a social studies and a few things like that, I remember, but I don't, and I think we got into a little bit of the government, but definitely we were not tested on the Constitution in this way or anything. So I think it would be good to have, because if you don't get it in school, you know, there's not too many, at least I wouldn't, as a 16-year-old, just pull out the old Constitution and start studying it, you know. So you have to try to catch up later in life. But it is really important, especially in this current climate where there's a lot of cracks in the foundation, I guess you could say, of the U.S., and a lot of opinions, it's good to know what the foundation actually is.
Yeah, I think without starting young and when they're in grade school and just before they go to university, I think it's important to have that foundation, because that's the benchmark. That's where we judge everything, whether it's legal or illegal. That's the very foundation of our society. And also, you don't understand America's role in the world without understanding the Constitution, because America's whole role internationally is just a mirror of what goes on inside of America. America exports freedom because we had freedom internally through the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, all the founding documents. So I think it not only is it important for the knowledge and for understanding politics in the world, it's even for figuring out who he should be as an American, the kind of ideals you should have, the kind of things you should support, because any kind of Constitution is part of your identity. And I think that's important to allowing these young people to form the kind of person they're going to be. They do need to know those documents.
There's some great books at thetrumpet.com. There's America Under Attack and also No Freedom Without Law, that those two talk about a lot that's happening here in the U.S. So make sure you get those for free at thetrumpet.com, and that'll give you some good insight into what's going on in the country today. Here's an interesting write-up from CNN. Stranger Than Fiction, they talk about how this forbidden book was smuggled out of North Korea. Usually you think of forbidden books being smuggled into North Korea because every book is forbidden, right? But there's one that was written there that has been smuggled out. It seems pretty interesting. They say it was written by a dissident writer still living inside the country, under a pen name, of course. The book is titled The Accusation, Forbidden Stories from Inside North Korea. It's a collection of short stories about the lives of regular people who live without freedom and are under constant scrutiny. It is fiction, apparently, but they say it is a pretty good reflection of life under North Korean rule. The author is known simply as Bandy, which is Korean for firefly. It's a pen name. And they say it doesn't deal with political prison camps or public executions, human rights issues, things like that. It just shows the normal life of North Korea citizens, and it is very frightening. The book shows that they live like slaves. That'd be an interesting read if you could get it.
Even outside the labor camp, and that's a pretty powerful point there, that even when you're talking about North Koreans who have it pretty good, it's still bad. We're not even talking about the ones who everyone in the world knows are suffering in those camps or who have been brutally tortured and killed. These are the everyday people who just are on the street working, and they're still under that kind of terrible condition.
Well, it's a frightening system, because it seems like, from the reports that we, you know, see in the news, even the higher up you get, the more in danger you are.
Mm.
Because eventually you get killed, it seems like. And that happened with the brother, right? Or half-brother.
Yeah, half-brother, I think.
Killed at the airport recently. And so, it would be really interesting that this book was smuggled out. They have a whole story about how they got it out and so forth, which is pretty interesting. But I thought the main thing of interest was just how they show that, as you were saying there, Grant, these are the normal people of North Korea, as they're called, and their lives are very bad. They're not in the camps, quote-unquote, but in a way, they live like slaves.
Yeah, I think this would be a very interesting read, just because it's kind of like what Leo Tolstoy and Jane Austen and all these other writers, they wrote fiction, but you get an idea of how people lived through the different characters and the setting and all that. And so I think for us, in the West, where we basically have no information about North Korea besides their nuclear program, besides what the leader says and does, and whenever Dennis Rodman goes over there. That's pretty much all we know about them. But I think this would just help a lot of American people identify with them and maybe see if there is a need for action to end their regime, because those people are living in a Middle Ages, Dark Ages type of society in the 21st century. And that should not be, especially since it was created by partly from American failure to stop it in the 50s. So I think a book like this could really help spark some kind of vigor in American society to try to set the course right in the peninsula.
Well, and it does. It should really give us an appreciation for freedom of speech, freedom of the press. They can't write anything over there. And we can do whatever we want here pretty much in the U.S. And a lot of times that gets kind of abused, I think, because it becomes very ideological what people are writing, as opposed to just trying to get a truth out there and show the story of these, you know, the way these people are living. So I think there's probably a good lesson in that, too, to appreciate the freedom to communicate and not to take it lightly or abuse it.
Yeah, and it's also pretty sobering to think about just the type of paranoia that always seems to grip these communist countries, especially at the very top. The leader is so concerned of people near him trying to overthrow him, or even any basic family in the country speaking against him, that he has to basically kill off or imprison huge parts of the population. That just shows you how much misery communism brings, not just the flawed system itself, but also when the leader is so paranoid.
And, you know, it is another example there, too, of kind of mob rule. Now, the mob happens to be the leader at the top and his people. But, you know, here in the U.S., we've seen that sort of happen with, and we're going to talk about that here in a little later with a story you have, Grant, but where the media really can incite something and they kind of rush to judgment and say somebody's guilty of something before all the facts come out. Well, that does happen very specifically in communist countries, Russia under Stalin, of course, North Korea today, and where you're guilty because they say you are. And there's nothing you can do about it, and they're, a lot of times they'll execute you. And so we should appreciate the the freedoms in this country and reserving judgment sometimes until things can actually be found out instead of rushing to judgment.
Yeah, well, I think there's freedom of the press, but there's also responsibility of the press. And that's the side that's thrown out the window today, is where it's amazing that we live in a society where you can publish almost anything and have your own opinion. You can you can research anything you want and publish something on it. But there does come the responsibility of seeking the truth, not misinforming the public, and basically manipulating them to your own gain. That is propaganda. That's what communist leaders are also good at. And it's a very fine line between freedom and responsibility, then abusing the freedom and just manipulating people to support you or to get something to happen when it goes against the laws of the country or what's really best for everyone.
So that's a pretty interesting book. If it's out there, I might try to get that myself. The Accusation: Forbidden Stories from Inside North Korea. Can't vouch for it. It might not be a good book. I don't know, but it sounds interesting. Do you guys feel like you're stressed out? Do you feel like you're under stress?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Once in a while, yeah, for sure.
It's killing you, by the way. Just want you to know that. I'm sure you can relax now. This is another write-up from CNN. Stress really is killing us. There are new clues that the high levels of stress many people endure every day are taking a deadly toll. We all have stress sometimes. I guess if it's a high level all the time, it's a problem.
And it's also interesting how much that comes down to screen time. We've seen that in a lot of studies, and the things we eat, the amount of sleep we get. A lot of these different health factors can determine that. Sometimes you can't change maybe how much is expected of you at work, but you can change some health habits that will help with that.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting because this is really hitting the white working Americans, as they say it, working class. And they say white very specifically, so I'm just reading their story here. It says, white working class Americans are dying in middle age at a rapidly increasing pace, reversing a long-standing trend toward greater life expectancy across all races and social classes, according to a new report. A recent study by the Hamilton Project looked at the psychological stress load in the U.S. using biological markers tied to cardiovascular, kidney, and liver function to create a stress load index. That stressed me out just reading that. This physical stress load, a precursor to many diseases, has increased in striking fashion since the late 70s. And, of course, now we're dying earlier, too. So there you go. There's some news for your Monday.
Yeah, that's somewhat depressing, and that ties in with what we talked about last Friday, about how depression is the world's leading cause of physical ailments. And I think stress probably plays a big role in that, because when you're stressed out, it's easy to allow yourself to become negative and move into depression and other things. And I think, like we've talked about so much, all these societal issues are really building up and hitting the middle class the most. Unemployment, there's the drug epidemics, opioids, mm-hmm. and heroin, and all these different things that people are resorting to because they can't either find a solution to whatever their circumstances are, or I guess they get so stressed out that seems like the only solution to finding any kind of relief. And it's just interesting to see that if we can't handle those things, it produces so many major problems that they get out of control. No one knows what to do about them anymore.
Yeah, and this is really interesting. This ties in, this study ties into something, Grant, you talked about last week too, a few times, about how they identify a problem, but then their cause that they come up with for it is really sort of strange. They say that, well, this is happening because of people don't have as much money or things. That's why the stress is rising. But then they kind of contradict themselves by saying, well, this is hitting the white middle class, but it's not rising the same levels in the poorer classes. But they say, well, the poorer classes are doing a little better than they used to do. That's why it's kind of weird how they're trying to justify it. What about lifestyle? What about broken families? What about broken laws? I think that's where the stress is coming from.
Yeah, we always hear in elections, too, about how certain policies kill the middle class. So I don't know if there's anything specific about that, but clearly that's not getting back to the real cause, which is, like you were talking about, there are a lot of laws that are being broken. That's what we're not really looking at all.
I yesterday ran some errands around town, went to a few different shops, and I was commenting to my wife last night. I said, you know, it's just really interesting. I didn't see a lot of people that look very happy. And I wasn't really out looking for it. I just, you know, you notice the people that walk by you. People look either very much zoned in on their phone or whatever, or just not happy, disgruntled in some fashion. And seeing somebody with a hint of joy and excitement, it's pretty rare. You don't see a lot of that today. At least I didn't yesterday.
Yeah, I usually just see that in Toys R Us when the kids are running around the store. But yeah, it's just walking around. I went shopping couple days last week with my wife, and some people are very pleasant, and they're kind of in the same boat as you were, just walking around and trying to get stuff done in the evening. But some of them, they're just very stressed, rushing around. Their kids are wanting to do this and that. They're tired, and then you're trying to get everything done. It's just some very difficult living circumstances for some people, and I think you can just see it in public all the time. And I think everyone can remember an event in the last day or two where you saw someone looking like they're having a really rough day. And if that's how they're living all the time, you can see how it's not going to amount to an abundant life of happiness and joy.
a very specific example of that, and this isn't to make me look good, but it's just an example. We're walking through the store yesterday, my wife and I, two kids, just normal, doing nothing special, just walking. We walk by a few older people. And as we walk by, I hear the older lady say, "What a nice family." And we weren't doing anything special, but you just don't see a lot of families out. And I think that's what she was referring to. So it was just interesting. I think that reflects on society pretty in an interesting way.
Were you wearing matching clothes?
We were not.
Okay.
No, we were not. I try to avoid that at all costs. But no.
Well, the fact you weren't doing anything, though, that actually can go a long way. Yeah. The fact the kids aren't running everywhere, right. The fact that the parents are not so buried in their devices that they don't even realize what the kids are doing, that can actually make a pretty big difference.
Yeah, so I hate to bring it up in a way because it makes it sound like I'm doing something great, but I think it was just because you don't see a lot of it. because we were literally doing nothing. We were just walking. And I'm sure I was slouching or something that wasn't good. But in any event, they thought it was okay. So, but yeah, it was just interesting. So they do say these stressors are causing a lot of problems for people, whatever the cause might be. And the news isn't getting better. People are getting more and more stressed, and it's causing health problems. And so try to avoid the stress if you can.
Yeah, there's really an important balance with this subject of stress, because obviously stress does turn people to a lot of wrong solutions. We've talked about alcohol or drugs or anything like that, a lot of other time-wasting distractions where we can try to escape reality. But at the same time, the greatest people in history have basically used stress as a driving factor. You can't let it get to an extreme where it destroys health, but obviously if you're using it the right way and harnessing it the right way and taking care of yourself while trying to reach a higher level, actually stress could be a good thing sometimes.
Yeah, there's definitely good levels of stress, and you know, you need to have a little bit of a prod on you to do something. There's not, that's good, but it's becoming a problem for some people, probably because again, they don't see a solution, or it's not like a positive stress to get something done. It's a negative, my world's collapsing on me sort of stress.
Yeah, take away someone's hope, and that probably takes years off their lives as well.
Yeah, I would. That happens a lot, and you do see it where people do kind of give up on life a little bit, and it causes problems. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here at 101.3 KPCG and online. We're at kpcg.fm. If you would like to follow us on Twitter, you're welcome to do so. At KPCGFM. It's free. Got to pay for your internet, though. we can't pay that for you. And you can send email, any emails you'd like to, comments at KPCG.FM. We appreciate those. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today on this Monday. Abraham, you've got an interesting write-up here about looking for animals that are supposed to be extinct, but they may not be. And I've got a story right before you get into yours, kind of related. It says, extinct creature sightings are piling up in Australia. There's multiple reports of Tasmanian tiger sightings. It's not a tiger, by the way. It's a carnivorous marsupial. So there's been a lot of sightings of this guy, but they say it's supposed to be extinct. So, and then now a story you have is from the Indian Express. Fresh hunt for Tasmanian tiger nearly 80 years after extinction. So this guy is supposed to be gone, but he's around. Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, this is really fascinating, because I think everyone has heard of the Tasmanian tiger before, and
I've heard of the Tasmanian devil. I never heard of the Tasmanian tiger, though.
Right. I guess they're two different marsupials, but somewhat related. This is the one. It's like it looks like a wolf or like a big dog with tiger stripes on it on its back with a stiff tail. And the last one seen in nature was in 1930, and the last one died in captivity in 1936. So it was put on the extinct species list. But now, according to some reports in Queensland, Australia, they think they might have seen a few in the heartland of Australia. So there's this huge tiger hunt going on in Australia to find it, because it's something that would be incredible if they somehow...
Yeah.
Lived for 80 years without anyone seeing them.
They're just hiding. But yeah. I thought the headline was funny because it said, fresh hunt for Tasmanian tiger, as if, you know, hey, they're still alive, let's go get them.
Yeah.
They didn't mean it that way, I'm sure, but that's the way I thought it was kind of funny. They found an animal they thought was dead, so they have to make sure they go out and hunt it now.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, I'm sure some people would want to hunt it and capture some of them. But I think it's interesting because with extinct animals... Even I watched part of Planet Earth 2 that came out in America this month, and there have been, with the snow leopards, there's so few of them alive, and they've just been able to figure out how they interact, because there's so few, they barely see them, they live up in the mountains, they can't really observe them that well. So we're just learning about how they interact and how the species acts. So I'm not surprised that something like this, where there might just be a few of them alive, escape or trying to flee humans, because that's a big reason why they did go extinct in the first place, why they would be hidden away, especially in Australia, where it's full of the most dangerous animals on earth and desolate wilderness where nobody lives anyway. So there's lots of spaces for them to hide. But the hunt for the tigers is being done by James Cook University. being led by Dr. Sandra Abel. They're using 50 high-tech camera traps, so different cameras around, and if something walks by, it triggers it, and they see if they can get pictures. And everyone's really excited about this because it is a symbol of Australia, of Tasmania. It would also be amazing if a species did survive and that we can see it again and observe it instead of just on videos and pictures.
That would open up, I'm sure, if they do find it, that obvious question. Well, if that's still around, what else is still around?
Yeah.
Dinosaurs? Probably not. But there could be certain things, I suppose, that they think are not around, and they are, and we just haven't seen them.
Yeah, I think there's lots of examples for that, especially the ones who live in extreme habitats like this. It's easy to miss them, especially back in the past where we didn't have all the technology we have today. It'd be easy for them to slip by undetected. So with this one, it would be really exciting to see if they can find it. The reason for this hunt is there've been two individuals who have come to the authorities and say they saw like a huge dog with stripes on its back, and that doesn't explain anything that lives in that area except for a Tasmanian tiger. So, and they're apparently pretty well a lot of credibility to the two individuals as well. So
it's not like the Bigfoot guy.
Yeah,
that's not, you see on YouTube. So I see, yeah. Saw Bigfoot out in Carolinas. Yeah,
yeah. It's funny too with all these things. Some people go through really elaborate hoaxes, like the Bigfoot video,
yeah,
like, and all these other things. So, interesting to see if this is actually has any tangibility behind it or if it's not. But hopefully it is, because it'd be amazing to see one in person, and just know that they exist and they play a role in the ecosystem.
Yeah, well, it's very fascinating. I was trying to think of what other animal might be on that list. I don't know what all the extinct animals are supposedly, but it would be interesting to see if there's more out there. And they always find new things too, you know, that they didn't know existed. So there's a lot to learn about Earth still, which is interesting, and what inhabits this planet.
Yeah, well, I think they usually say that we know more about the universe than the ocean, which, not too sure about that. Maybe we assume we know more about the universe than the ocean, but still, that just shows how little we've been able to explore because of the intense environment there. But even like we talked about on previous programs, the deep sea exploration, they find hundreds of new species. They go into Amazon, they find hundreds of new species all the time. So,
and new tribes of people always.
Yeah.
If you can, I don't know if I believe that, but it seems like every once a month there's a headline about some new tribe they discovered that's never seen civilization.
Yeah.
That one seems a little harder for me to believe, but I don't know. Maybe that's true too.
Yeah, that one, it's hard to believe that they wouldn't have run into someone before. Maybe they didn't, just no one knew about it or documented it. But yeah, even that shows that some societies, they just stay hidden, and it takes a lot of work to find them.
Well, maybe it's just people that were on a reality show and didn't know it ended.
Right.
Like the people from last week. They've been in a reality show since the early 2000s and didn't realize what happened. You know, it makes me think, too, they're talking about putting up those cameras. You never know what you're going to see out there.
Yeah.
They set some up, it was somewhere here in the U.S., to try to see, like, some sort of an animal. And they saw a guy running through the woods. I think he didn't have a lot of clothes on either. He's like out in the middle of nowhere. And they found him, and anyway, he had some issues going on, but they captured something they didn't expect to capture, which was a human being running through there.
Yeah, well, I think you brought up that article. This was months ago, but there was a cougar in the area, so they put up cameras to see if they could track it down. And people knew the cameras were there, so they started dressing up as things. And like one guy was in a gorilla, and one dressed up as an elderly person and just stood in front of the camera for hours or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah, people have really unique senses of humor. And so they find out you're doing something, they'll try to make a little hoax about it, I guess. But it would be neat if they could find something, I guess. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know what these things do. They sound like they could be kind of a rough creature to run across, this Tasmanian tiger. Kind of big from what the picture looks like, the drawing.
Yeah, I think they're one of the few carnivorous marsupials. So most marsupials are herbivores. They eat plants. But this one is like a dog. It eats different prey, but it's a marsupial. It has a little pouch where it puts its young. So it's very unique that way. There aren't too many species like that.
Yeah, it's really unique. Why did it die? Do you know? Or why did so many of them die? Were they hunted, or do they just...
I think it's, from what I understand about it, it's both people wanting them in zoos, and then also people hunting them for their furs and, and different things. So I think it's a combination of that, and also with the rapid expansion of people into Tasmania and Australia, that also upset their habitat a little bit. So I think it's a combination of all those different factors.
Yeah, it is interesting. Even here where we're broadcasting from, campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College, I mean, years ago, I remember when they started putting in some subdivisions out here, and then all of a sudden, you see a lot more deer because they were pushed out of their wooded home, and so they had to go somewhere else. And but so, yeah, anytime man goes into an area, the animals typically have to take off. You're not welcome here anymore, although I like to see the deer, but they're not comfortable hanging out by people's houses usually.
Yeah, it's amazing how, I mean, rapid, or people selling different areas is good. It's not a bad thing, but I think the way we do it is could be improved, because it does upset an environment we live in, and if it upsets it enough, it can cause a lot of problems in the long term. And I think we're finding that out in different parts of the world. But yeah, in especially in Alberta, when I lived there, there'd always be stories about bears walking in the Banff or different cities and looking for food because there's nothing, because their normal hunting grounds or that kind of thing are is where a city now stands. And even my dad was on military exercise in Churchill, Manitoba. That's way up north. And they built Churchill right on the migration path of the polar bears.
Huh.
So every year polar bears walk through the city.
Wow.
It's like the landfill's right where they walk.
Yeah.
So let's be careful. And it's their fault for putting it there, because it's the polar bears are just doing what they've done for generations, I guess. But they always have to be careful that time of year in case polar bears, like, they can come to your house, or if you're driving, you just have to be careful.
Wow. So you put like the warning sign instead of the deer, it's a polar bear.
Yeah, polar bear crossing.
That'd be awesome. That'd be really exciting to see, as long as you didn't get too close to it.
Yeah.
You've got another story for us here. Some of the history of Gibraltar and its relationship with Europe. Gibraltar, famous, the big rock island, I guess, as it is.
Yeah.
And Seagate there. And so you have some history about that.
Yeah, there's a story came out over the weekend. There's been a lot of contention between Britain and Spain over this. Even British MP saying that they might have to fight a war with Spain over Gibraltar.
Really?
Yeah, so it's a lot of controversy, and it's really heating up, and a lot of pretty harsh rhetoric going back between the EU and Britain, because Spain thinks that Gibraltar needs to be part of Europe because Britain's leaving Europe. And so the EU, if it comes to a decision between the two countries, the EU said they're going to rule in favor of Spain, which really doesn't matter because it's not the EU's responsibility for those things anyway. The people of Gibraltar have said several times that they want to be part of Great Britain. And so it's just going to be really interesting to see if Gibraltar becomes a bargaining chip for their negotiations. I think it's good to go through the history because this isn't the first time something like this has happened. And in fact, what's really interesting is with Gibraltar, Britain has used them several times as a bargaining chip. But it always ended up where they kept it. So I think it's good to go over this right now and see some of the history. And Gibraltar became a British colony in 1713 at the Treaty of Utrecht, which ended the 7 Years' War. And basically, that's the treaty that gave Britain control of lots of different territory across in North America and different places. And so ever since then, Gibraltar has been a British crown colony. Before that, it was conquered by the Moors and the Ostrogoths and all the different peoples going through Spain. But when it became a British colony, it gave Britain control of the entranceway to the Mediterranean. And Gibraltar is considered one of the two pillars of Hercules, the very thin passageway going from the Atlantic to the Mediterranean. So if you control Gibraltar, which is a peninsula jutting off of southern Spain, if you have a navy base there and you have ships there, you can block the whole sea of the Mediterranean, which is, for European powers, sometimes it's the only place where they have ships. So it's a very powerful position. Because if you can blockade the Mediterranean, their navies are pretty useless on a worldwide scale, especially for Britain, because they can't actually get to Britain if you can blockade them up there. So it's proven to be a great asset for Britain. It helped us win both world wars. It's helped Britain defeat Napoleon and all these different occasions. I think for people to know the most famous occasion ever in Gibraltar's history. And I think it's the moment that defined that the character of Gibraltar, of being like a hard, stubborn place that will never be defeated. I think that's kind of its reputation, the Rock of Gibraltar. That came on through the Great Siege. And the Great Siege lasted for 4 years, between June 1779 and February 1783. It's one of the longest sieges ever endured by the British Army, and they endured against the Spanish. The Spanish tried to conquer it. So for 4 years, they survived basically with no support because Britain was fighting other wars. And so they were in a very difficult position, but they endured terrible hardship, starvation, all these things. But the commander refused to surrender, and eventually the British fleet came and was able to break the siege of the peninsula. But it's that event, that 4 years of siege, that kind of defines who they are. And it endeared Britain to Gibraltar, because Britain also endured sieges on their island. And so that it kind of became a bonding link between the two colonies.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens, because it's so strategic that probably at the end of the day, it doesn't much matter what the Gibraltar people think.
Right.
Because they're going to be moved around by bigger powers. And obviously Europe would want them. The EU would want them. And so for the listeners, if they've read The United States and Britain in Prophecy, or if you've looked at that, you know that indication is a lot of those sea gates are not going to be in the possession of the West, Britain and America anymore. Though we've had quite a few, but have lost quite a few. And so we see that trend where they're going to other powers, and they're very valuable.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting with the timing of this is Gibraltar and the Falkland Islands south of Argentina. Those are really the last two strategic ports that Britain owns. And so you have this happen here where Gibraltar is under threat of becoming European. And then you have the 35th anniversary of the Falklands War, just happened either today or yesterday, one of the two, of the war ending. And if you look at Britain today, Britain does not have the capability to defend Gibraltar or the Falklands like they did 30 years ago. So if Argentina chose to invade the Falklands again, Britain would not be able to mount a fleet like they could under Margaret Thatcher to defend it. Also, they probably couldn't compete with Spain as well. I think Britain has one ship in Gibraltar, one small destroyer. Britain is no longer the massive navy. Royal Navy is just a mere skeleton of what it used to be. And so I think what we're finding out is the only reason why Gibraltar is still part of Great Britain is pride and tradition. Britain is no longer a global power, and sad as it is to say, they don't really have a need for Gibraltar anymore, because they no longer have the military power to enforce influence at these certain seaports. So I think it's just a sad ending to the British Empire, where probably it doesn't matter what Britain wants, it's going to be taken from them anyway, no matter what they do.
Yeah, and when you were talking about that, I kind of wonder what even, say, the people of Britain would think, like if they would see the value in it, if it came down to, like, we've got to go fight for this, or if they would say, well, this doesn't matter, it's not worth getting into. I don't know what they would think, but I'm curious.
I think, there is a big liberal part of Britain who would probably want to see the last vestiges of empire, the last symbol of the British Empire gone. But I think a lot of Britons are proud of their past, and they want to hold on to Britain. And I think it's the show kind of the character and the attitude of Britain, where they have the pride, but they don't have the power anymore to do anything with it, do anything with that pride to back it up. So you can be proud of your history, and that's good. But if your government basically strips away your military and makes so many mistakes where you're no longer a world power, I mean, that's their fault for weakening themselves so much where they can't even keep their possessions.
And who knows what the U.S. would do if it came to that, you know, if we would go in there and use our remaining military to help them or not. I mean, I think that's a pretty open guess as to what would happen. I don't think the past administration would have done anything. I don't know what the current one would do. So probably won't come to that, I would think. I would think it would be more of a just political wrangling. Ah, we're going to take this. we voted on it, however they end up doing it. But the idea of Britain mounting some sort of a military campaign is just doesn't seem realistic in any way.
Yeah, I mean, they should if they're attacked. I mean, that's their right. But Britain is building two new aircraft carriers, but they won't be ready for another couple of years. So their ability to have a counterattack against Spain or against Argentina, if they took the Falklands, it's inconceivable that would happen. But also, what makes the situation in Gibraltar so much more complicated is if Britain went to war against Spain, you're fighting within NATO, and then you're also fighting the EU. And so it just an impossibly complicated situation where Britain would lose politically in any other way because they could just be blockaded within their island because they don't have any friends in Europe anymore.
Yeah, bad deal if it came to that. And those are important places, some of the history of Gibraltar there and with Britain and the EU as well. Make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show that's coming up here in a bit on KPCG, also the Key of David program. Stop and check out thetrumpet.com to get a chance as well. Top story today, what does an election without voters look like? Answer, Hong Kong. Also, the songs of Hong Kong and Russia and China and prophecy, all that at thetrumpet.com. And in relation to Gibraltar, United States and Britain and prophecy, really good book to check out if you haven't done that or you haven't looked at it in a while. You can get that for free at thetrumpet.com. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live, this Monday edition. Thanks for joining us, spending some time with us. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your Monday. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.